Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to yet another podcast episode. And I'm sure that you've completed quite a few employee surveys in your work or during your work. And maybe you even have sent out a few yourself for others now to complete for you to gather data. And if you think that's what it takes to be an organization that listens, I've got some slightly bad news for you. It's not exactly, because surveys and pulse checks are absolutely fantastic and they are a great start, but they are not really listening. They are more discovery. They're usually that first step in the process. And to really zero in on specific business challenges and co-create solutions with your employees, you really have to listen purposefully and with empathy. And it takes more than just surveys. And how do you do that exactly? Well, I'm so glad you ask, because today I've got with me Sam Valentine, who is the listening and culture lead, employee experience lead at Miro. And he's helping the organization embrace new ideas and listen to its people so that they make insight-led decisions to accelerate their performance. We Got This showcases individuals and organizations that create people-focused workplace cultures to help it become the norm rather than the exception. It's something that will require a mindset shift, and probably not something that any of us can do alone. But together, we got this. Sam, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Without further ado, you're not going to escape my favorite icebreaker, which is, who did you want to be when you grew up when you were little?
I've been thinking very deeply about this question over the last few days, and I don't have a good answer for you. The problem I had when I was a child, and it's the problem I have now as an adult, is that I wanted to be a million different people at once. So I wanted to be an explorer, and I wanted to be a policeman, I wanted to be a football player and a rugby player, and I wanted to, you know, be an entrepreneur at one point. I sort of struggled to answer that other than by saying I wanted to experience as many different things as possible. And that's kind of what my whole career was being based around. And I think why I'm so invested in listening and that sort of empathetic listening. And it's purely selfish that I like to vicariously live off people's experiences. So I think that's a bit of a non-answer, but
I think that's the perfect answer to this question, because I don't want to say it's a trick question, but I would say it's an excuse question to give you an excuse to talk about that in whatever way it means is good for you. Because I think what you experienced, you said that you've been trying to think about this over the past few days to figure out an answer. A lot of guests have that same dilemma, same challenge. And by no stretch of the imagination is this question intended to cause kind of frustration, anxiety, and stress. Oh my God, what am I going to answer? Absolutely not. It's actually to realize that there is no right answer to this question. Because some people were kind of dead set. It's like, I'm really passionate, and they've discovered whatever makes them tick from a very young age. Fantastic. But the way you are very close to my heart in that sense, because I was the same. And it stays with me. That's part of my personality. And I'm actually curious whether that ability and that willingness for you to try different things and wanting to be different things as well, does that continue until today? Not just because of with the listening part, but in terms of what you want to do, what you want to engage in, kind of all the different tasks and jobs that you find yourself engaging in?
Yes, 100%. I've always sort of taken the principle of, and I've forgotten the name of the people who came up with this summary, so with the squiggly career approach, I'm happy to jump left, jump right, move forward, move backwards. And yeah, I sort of look back on my CV and I think, yeah, I've been in the workforce for 20 years. I've got counted up to, I think I've had 18, 19 jobs in that time. And there has been continuity. There's always been a sort of a link. But when I've spoken to recruiters in the past, and the people, and it's really difficult to explain this. Like, well, it's really obvious. I started off on this. I discovered I enjoyed doing this. So I went that way. Then I discovered over there that actually I wanted to do more communications. I went over that way. And so, yeah, I recognize this in my son as well at the moment, that restless sort of curiosity about things and always wanting to be moving. And that definitely helped shape my career and, you know, how I think about goal setting and career planning, all those sorts of things.
No, I've had the same thing back in my employee days when I was looking for work and trying to put things down on the CV. It was a nightmare because there wasn't a job in marketing or project management. That was kind of my forte, my expertise. There wasn't a job advert in that direction that I didn't look at and kind of go, of course I can do that, right? Pharmaceuticals, yeah, could do that. Did that for 6 years. Can I do IT? Of course I can do that. Can I do food and fast moving goods? Of course I can. Fashion, you know, you name it. I can. There's not one thing. Yeah, is it going to be tough? Is it going to be challenging? Will it push me out of my comfort zone? Absolutely. But you know, yes, I'm willing to go through that stress, through that anxiety, and you know, learn and see where I can go with this. Because I've got a skill set, I can adopt, I can adapt, I can acquire the necessary skills. I've got that flexibility.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one thing, yeah, I've again, this is sort of the benefit of age and experience a little bit. I was laid off late last year, and so doing a bit of job hunting and going through that process. And I remember having this conversation with recruiters and interviewers and saying, yeah, honestly, if you want someone to keep a firm hand on the rudder and sail a ship through calm waters, and like, that's not me.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna be satisfied. If you want someone to jump into ambiguity, learn, yeah, probably make some mistakes, but hopefully sort of have some fun along the way, then that's what I'm interested in. That's what keeps me going. And I think it's that exact same thing. The willingness, I think, or the excitement that comes from, oh, actually, I could try my hand at that, and I think I could be good over there.
Yeah,
which
the same. The ambiguity and the grayness between the black and the white and the in between. I'm not as great at that, but I'm definitely kind of willing to give something a go. I'm willing to give something a try and see how I land in my own way. I lean more towards analysis, of course, but again, kind of that more binary look of the world is easy for me to make sense with. But the same as you said, it's like that the recruitment process, for me, it was always difficult to a certain point that I often found it very, very soul destroying. And I think I still do in a sense when I look at, you know, what companies are looking for. And now what really scares me is when I see all sorts of LinkedIn articles and YouTube videos about how you can use ChatGPT to help create job specs in 10 seconds. That scares me because ChatGPT is a fantastic tool, but it knows sod all about your organization, about your culture, about what makes people tick within that organization. And that is scary, and many people don't realize that.
I'm with you 100%. I get ChatGPT. I'm using AI a little bit at the moment. It's mind blowing. It's game changing, but it's not a substitute for the humanity, the empathy. And yeah, I think, yeah, why I'm really happy where I ended up at Miro is that, yeah, it was about a culture fit and it was about personality and, you know, the people I met along the interview. We obviously asked questions about technical experience, but it really felt like actually there was kind of empathy there and it was looking more at the behavioral side, which is so important. And obviously such a big predictor of retention and such a big predictor of performance as well. Like the ability to tick the technical box is not going to predict long-term performance and retention.
Yeah.
And that's what, yeah, that's what ChatGPT is going to struggle with.
It's a great tool. I'm using it very, very often. It helps me in what I call the spaghetti stage, which is when I throw spaghetti against the wall to see what sticks in terms of ideas for content and whatever else for the work that I do. Genuinely has made my life a lot easier. But again, that's the first step. That's the first layer. I then need to apply, okay, how does this sit with reality? And as you said, kind of listening to the empathy and so on. And I think these tools are great and they have a long way. I don't know how long it's going to take, but the way is still there. We need to continue working on that. That kind of gives us a tiny inadvertent segue into what we wanted to talk about, which is organizational listening and how to do that effectively. I made a bold statement around surveys, and actually that comes out, I'll give you credit when credit is where credit's due, about the listening and discovery, the difference between surveys and that. That's what came from our initial conversation a few weeks ago. But maybe for those who might not know, are not fully familiar with the concept, so just kind of we're on the same page. What do you mean by organizational listening? We'll get to how to make it effective maybe a little bit later on, but at that very early stage, what does that mean? How does that work at Miro, for example?
So my sort of working definition of listening is collecting strategic data from people to help drive performance. So surveys are really, really important. Yeah, there's an employee expectation, I think, that the surveys are there, that there is mechanisms to be listened to. But this thing, I think, is more in-depth than that. It's actually collecting sort of specific data or insight that helps drive strategic decision-making. So should you, if you've got a limited budget, should you prioritize investment into well-being or should you prioritize salary increases? Which teams might need the most support at the moment? If you've got a big sprint coming up but you need a project to done it pretty quickly, which teams are going to need the most support and the most of cushioning around them? So it's that ability to identify the drivers of business performance. And that sounds kind of cold and sounds very corporate. I mean it in completely the opposite way to that. It's about, based on the principle that when people are happy and healthy and thriving, the business is going to be happy and healthy and thriving as well. And that's a strategic choice for organizations. So it's just putting those links together. And it's a very wide sort of scope. I think data comes from sentiment analysis like surveys, but you've also got to look at retention rates and turnover and sickness rates and look at what people are saying at performance review time and look at the feedback from retros or customer feedback or understanding sort of the comments that might come up at town halls or what that conversations are looking like and being able to be very focused at what you're extracting from that to solve some of the business questions which are going to help the ultimate strategy. So surveys are really important. They're a big part of it, but they are just a part of it. And there's a whole lot more that goes into that.
And in terms of, because I'm glad you picked that up, that it does sound a little bit corporate because it can do, right? When we saw pulse surveys or surveys, pulse checks, whatever, right? My kind of, I'll play devil's advocate here a little bit. A lot of the times when I send out surveys as part of the work that I do to get a feel for what things are like within the organization before we do any culture work and then do after, it's like pulling teeth. And I know the reason for that is because people have been inundated with surveys. And that's the first bit. The second part, they've done the surveys and nothing changed. So when the next time they get a survey, what's the point? I won't get to the point of just yet when you send a survey out and although everything's on fire and falling over, the surveys indicate otherwise that everything's peachy and rosy. But that's probably definitely a separate conversation, maybe even a separate episode. But all the things that you've mentioned in terms of gathering that information, that does seem like a hell of a lot. Starting with surveys, pulse checks, gathering things from town halls and all these various data points. Isn't that overwhelming for people? Somebody in your department, like in your role, in your department, you've got a dedicated role, you've got a dedicated department on bureau for that. But what about organizations who might not have that and it's part of somebody's job role in the HR department? How can you scale that down a little bit for us?
Yes, it's a good question. I always sort of rely on, just to come back a couple of sentences. I've shamelessly stolen this from Culture Amp, and I use this.
I love Culture Amp. Yeah,
I'm a big fan, and this I remember Culture Amp saying this on some session. But people don't get surveyed; people get lack of action fatigued, and that's the thing, right? How are you taking action? How do surveys lead to actions? The other thing, the principle I always talk about whenever I'm having conversations with teams or leaders and sort of coaching managers is the survey is the direction, not the destination. So a survey is very much a rough tune. It's the listening that happens afterwards that's the fine tune. So to come to, I guess, the question that you asked, I think, the mistake that I certainly made early in my career, and I see happening quite a lot as well, is people taking a really expansive approach and starting with a really large data set and trying to find problems or trying to find solutions within that data set. So if you go out and ask a survey of 45 questions, you're going to find a lot of problems. You're going to find a lot of areas. That can lead to overwhelm. That can be paralyzing. It then gets really difficult for managers and leaders to start to prioritize and measure. Whereas if you flip it around and start with the problem you're trying to solve, or start with a hypothesis to test. For example, if we increase flexible working options in our American offices, will that increase retention by 1 year? You can start to find the data. So you can tailor the survey questions you're asking, specifically what to look for, you know what to target when you're doing the quantitative analysis, and then you know how to do the fine tuning through maybe focus groups or correlation analysis, whatever it might be. So to scale it down, yeah, I always give this advice to people: start with the problem, start with the hypothesis, and use survey, use listening mechanisms to test. Along the way, they'll do some discovery as well, and there'll be some exploration, and then it'll always be a home for the big diagnostic survey. But start with a really specific question in mind and work from there.
That is a very, very useful piece of advice, because it's something that, again, is close to my heart. We start way too broad. There are many, many examples. And one of the first ones that came to mind for me, most likely because I've had a conversation about this recently, is when we talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion. We try to change our organizations, you know, from one extreme to another. These are long-term initiatives. It's not just about your recruitment process, who you get on board and when you get them on board and how do you change the makeup of the teams and the organization, things like that. But then also, and I had Marcin Florian from Spotify on the podcast talking about this earlier in the year, that organizations do that. They get people, get diverse people, build that equity, build that inclusion, and then they hand it over to team leads. But they actually haven't figured out how to help those team leads manage a diverse group of people. That's a big, big challenge. And what they're trying to do, everything at once. And my advice always, okay, pick one, two things max. Try that first, because otherwise you're gonna burn yourself out. Even if you don't fail, at the very least, you're gonna burn yourself out, and it's not worth it. So it's good to hear that piece of advice where you say, pick one thing. And I find it very interesting that it's with a hypothesis that we've got this assumption, meaning we don't have the answer. Isn't that scary for people, for teams, for organizations? What have you seen? Again, maybe at Miro or maybe beyond Miro.
It is scary. I think it is scary, and it is maybe a different approach. And yeah, I've seen it be sort of challenging and confronting. I see it kind of the opposite though, and I think that actually it's more inclusive. I think I've seen as well when you sort of maybe suggest the challenges and go in with that kind of fixed mindset of, this is a challenge we need to solve. That can maybe put the barriers up. That can start to increase defensiveness and start to look like black or white. I think if you go in with a hypothesis and say, okay, we think that well-being scores are declining and this is because of uncertainty in the external environment, or we think that this merger process is causing this team here to feel less comfortable in their role, that you can have the discussion before a survey comes. You can apply the context to it, and you can say, you can actually involve people in that hypothesis formation, but also what the underlying reasons might be. And then you're kind of on that voyage of discovery together. So I think it's a way of building that sort of coalition or partnership approach to test and explore. Because once you come to the other side, and again, this is like a really key principle that I always say to people, as an employee experience person, what I can give you is the red boxes and the green boxes, and I can give you 74%, and I can give you a trend line that's doing that. What I can't really give you is the context of your team. I can't say, okay, you've got maybe a toxic manager here, or really talented people here, or a project that's been a massive success over here. It's when you put those things together that the magic happens, and that you get the insight. And I think if you have that kind of hypothesizing approach, it's much easier to put the data and the context together at an early stage, do the testing and exploration, then come out the other side and say, okay, well, this is clear. And it's clear what the route forward is as well. So it is kind of scary and confronting on the one hand, but also I think on the other hand, it's relied much, much more on partnership. And again, just sort of probably a mistake, I think, that another one that I would sort of definitely change in how I approach things is 10 years ago, it was probably HR running the survey. HR managed the survey, and then you'd see it as a manager, you'd probably get a knock on the door at some point saying, well, let's go through your survey results, red box, red box, red box. And that doesn't feel good. That's not a particularly empowering way of going about things. And it's probably not likely to lead to great actions. Whereas if you start with, we're doing this together, you know, you as a manager, you as a leader, what are you worried about at the moment? Let's test together and find the information that you need. It's much more in partnership. And I think, yeah, it leads to much more specific and targeted actions at the end of it as well.
Thank you very much. That's definitely my preferred way of doing things as well, especially that last bit. Because I'm asking that question about whether it's scary. It's because, again, that's something that I often experience. And that's one of the things that I work with. Any kind of cultural change or cultural transformation, it tends to bring kind of defenses up. And that's quite normal in any organization. Yeah. And the way you approach it, absolutely love it. I stand by that. I would do exact same advice, very similar approach as often as possible. So it was a bit of a, again, devil's advocate type of question. I'm definitely on your side in this exchange. That one last thing that you've mentioned about, it used to be HR that did the survey, and then you basically met with a team lead and in a way gave him a roller king because, you know, it's all red boxes, right? Things have changed, and they definitely have to come more from individual teams. Absolutely. What happens in a hypothetical scenario where you've got HR who believes that you come into an organization and go to a few team leads and say, listen, this is what we'd love to do. We'd love to listen. We'd love to find out, but we need your help. We need your input. But that one or those team leads are kind of very skeptical because, again, they've been burnt in the past. How could someone in that position convince, show, get that person on board? And again, I'm not expecting hard and fast rules, step-by-step guidance. Again, from kind of your experience, if we could provide a bit of guidance on this, how would you approach that?
So this is a situation that's faced many, many times.
I did have an inkling that you might have.
Yeah, ultimately, again, employee experience, workplace culture, talent development, you know, communications, it's 99% relationships. Yeah, all of the work is relationships and trusted relationships and partnerships. And in those situations, I think it's just been really, really important to build trust and to build relationships and to build the credibility that we're here to support and partner with people. And that might take a bit of time. It might take a bit of effort. It's probably going to take a bit of role modeling. It's probably like any change process, going to start with a few early adopters, building up a bit of a critical mass, and then sort of, you know, showing that, you know, things are a bit different or there's a new way to do this. And I think a really, really large part of that is messaging. I hear a lot with survey results that are good results or bad results, that things are good or things are bad. And that always sort of makes me nervous when I hear that, because context is everything. So a score that's good in one context might be bad in another context. But it's also, yeah, again, to sort of to repeat to people, like the only bad scores you're getting is when people aren't telling you anything. If people are really unhappy, they're all telling you that they're unhappy and what to do about it. And that's an amazing opportunity. And that's something that is rare and something that is incredibly valuable. And it's sort of showing to managers, whoever it is, there's no judgment here. We're looking for opportunities to improve, because of course we're always looking for opportunities to improve, because, you know, that's the nature of every business, is continually improving how we do things, why we do things, when we do things. And that's kind of a credibility conversation there as well. And that, I think, helps smooth the way. And it's just, you know, that slight change in approach. You're not being judged for having red boxes. You're being supported to take advantage of the opportunities that people are presenting to you. And I think that can take time, but it's, you know, for me and my team, I think the steer I give to my teams is invest as much time as you possibly can in the relationships with people as an equal partnership. We're not here to tell people what to do. We're here to support and coach and have conversations to help other people be at their best, so they can help their teams be at their best. And it's, yeah, it's a bit sort of positive psychology, but I think really keeping the focus on positivity, on opportunities, and on context as well, I think just helps really solve that and make that a smooth process.
I'm guessing it will be very, very, answer is going to be very, very similar to what you've just said. But nonetheless, I want to pull at that thread a little bit of what I've mentioned before. Let's assume the team lead is on board. You want to do this. You want to do this survey as the one of the first steps. How do we avoid a situation where, as I said, everything is falling apart, everything's on fire, every project is beyond limits, beyond deadlines, and we're burnt out. But then we do the survey and the results come out all green boxes. Everybody knows that this is not because people held back. People did not put in what they really mean, what they really feel. Questions around, are you looking for work? They said no. And actually, they've applied to 20 companies this week and so on. So what is it? At which stage do we tackle it? I know it's part of a wider problem for sure within the organizations and psychological safety and trust in terms of how people feel about voicing their concerns openly. But just using that part, that stage around the surveys, is there anything that can be done in how we do that? So how we message around that with things that you've mentioned? If you're going to be, if it's just more of what you said before, that's absolutely fine. But is there anything that we can do a little bit more specifically to prevent that from happening?
Yeah, I mean, in that scenario, that sounds like a very low trust environment. That sounds like a very low psychological safety environment. I'd guess in those sorts of environments there are, and it's I don't think it's a common thing, but it definitely happens, and we definitely see it in some texts and some sections. You know, that people will score everything really highly because there's a bit of fear of a manager or fear of repercussions, and that's why I think it's really important as well if you sort of have that contextual knowledge to look at what people say, but also look at what people do. And that's not to discredit surveys, the feedback. There is, you know, I was saying that situation. Yeah, we've got people's voiced sentiment. But if we have a look at turnover rates, and if we have a look at sickness rates, and if we talk to the employee relations team, you might sort of start to build up a different picture. And actually, you know, in that scenario, you probably would want to go up the vertical a little bit and have some difficult conversations with leaders and understand what is causing that lack of psychological safety, but also looking at the impact on it as well. And there's a really clear impact there that we're not getting an honest representation. We're not getting the opportunities to improve based on what people are saying. So that probably comes back to leadership communications. That's probably coaching conversations with managers. You know, it's a very, very long process to build the psychological safety back up. But I would sort of see incredibly high scores across the board, yeah, especially when you get low participation rates as well, or even very high participation rates. So if you start to get up to sort of 95-100% participation rate in surveys, that looks like it could be coercion. It looks like people feel they could be penalized for not taking surveys. That would also be a flag. So I'd say that would also be something to look into, as much as really negative scores would be. It's a situation that needs approaching very carefully and very sensitively, but it's a potential flag there as well.
I was fully aware asking that question that there is no right answer, and you can't solve that with a survey. Nonetheless, I really appreciate how you kind of approach that, because it opened a little route for me in terms of how I think about this, that it's worth breaking it down in a way. So it's not necessarily, and I think it kind of connects with what you said in terms of the role of leadership in this. It says, you know, taking that survey, all nice and great and red and green and everything's fine and hunky-dory, and leadership saying, listen, how is this and how is the reality, right? There's a disconnect, and having, I think, dialogue about that around, again, in that process of, as you said, of building trust, building that psychological safety. It's the leaders that they need to approach, that they need to voice this, they need to bring up people within organizations. I know people because, you know, every team, they don't have to be on the senior leaders. They don't have to even be leaders. They can be individual contributors. You've got people who have absolutely no objections, and more power to them, raising their hand and calling bullshit. And saying, listen, this is not that. And we need more people like that, because some people have that innate ability that they just are not afraid of that. And by doing that, again, that role modeling that you mentioned, that will hopefully encourage other people to go, actually, you know what? He, she, they are right in that. I'll do the same thing. And again, it's the leaders, I think, it's on them to say, listen, this is not matching up. but not in a judgmental, not in an accusatory way, saying, help us understand this, right? Where's the gap? What are we missing?
Yeah, and I think in that scenario as well, I'm sort of going back, there was two hypotheses at play there. So one hypothesis is, which I sort of went straight to, is it's low psychological safety. People aren't really saying what they mean. Maybe we're discouraging people from speaking up. The other hypothesis is that we've got it wrong. And actually everything is great and people are really happy. And yeah, we've misread the other signals. And I think, yeah, diving into that and, yeah, you've got to test both of those hypotheses, you know, to see where the truth lies. But yeah, it's also, yeah, and this is part of coaching conversations, you know, and I think that there can be a fear sometimes of the people who criticize. And I've seen that temptation to jump to who said that, who wrote that comment, rather than, yeah, this hurts, but at least they're saying it. And there's a bit of a mindset shift as well. We don't want everyone complaining all the time, but we want enough people to be raising the challenges that it makes us think about, are we doing the right thing? And the answer could be, yes, we are, but some people aren't going to like it. Or actually, there are better ways of doing things. And those critical voices are hugely, hugely important. Like, if we didn't have them, there'd be no point doing all the listening stuff, because you just end up confirming what you're doing. And that's not a healthy, productive society. So yeah, it's again sort of in embracing, and that's manager empowerment as well. And that's really sort of, yeah, one of the aims of listening and a culture of listening is embracing the diversity of thought and diversity of experience, diversity of opinion. And that's something that's so fundamental.
What I've noticed with leaders, when often we do any type of engagement surveys, or when they do engage on their own, and people do put things down, and I very often sense this inner conflict in leaders. They notice something within that. Somebody speaks up, somebody says something, and the leader wants to, with the best of intentions, you know, ask additional questions, prod that to find out more. But for some reason, it comes out either because how they communicate, or maybe something on the other side, how it's being received by the employees, that they're kind of being punished for that, right? Now all of this big inquisition, who said that? Why did you say that? Well, in reality, it's just literally to get a better understanding of situations. And I often sense that in leaders, that's an inner conflict as a result of that. Now, very often it happens that they do things like that, and they do want to get to the bottom of it. But the intentions is not that they are not pure on their side, but they are more around kind of still tainted by a little bit of micromanagement and control. Let's put it right. Not punishment, but just kind of really understanding. So I really need to get to the bottom of this. We need to sort this out. That kind of command and control element. And that's what I've often seen with any type of kind of research, engagement, pulse surveys happen quite often.
Yeah, no, I definitely see that conflict happen a lot. And yeah, like you, I would say pretty much every leader I've worked with, I don't think I've sort of encountered any exceptions to that, have really genuinely cared, and really genuinely wanted to know what's going on. But yeah, it's kind of left out of narratives quite a lot. Like, leaders are human too. Leaders are humans, and reading comments about, yeah, which can be critical or can be constructive, can take an emotional toll. And I sort of, you know, how we work with leaders to sort of, yeah, cope with that and manage that. You know, if you're in charge of a function of 600 people, 700 people, you're going to get comments saying, this is the worst leader ever, this is the worst decision. And you're going to get comments saying, this is great, this is a great decision. You've got to be able to hold those conflicting views in your head a little bit and sort of piece that together, which is again why the partnership approach is so important. And again, that's probably 10, 15 years ago, where you just print off the comments and hand them over to someone to read through them all. It's not a viable way of doing it, because that just opens, that's incredibly subjective, it opens to bias, it takes a heavy emotional toll. But instead of sort of staging through and really, you know, to bring it back to an earlier conversation, how you focus down on, yeah, we've got our survey, or we've done our listening, we've asked 5, 6, 10, or 40 questions. What's really, really important? Let's focus on them. Now let's look at what the people who are neutral or conflicted are saying, and let's focus on them. and you can really cut it down and focus. Now let's go to the people who are negative and let's see what the themes are. Now let's go to the people who are positive and see what the themes are, and are there any consistencies? So again, so I think the support you put in place to help just sort of navigate and focus and drill down to specifics is the way to keep it constructive. Otherwise, I think, yeah, there is quite a big risk of it being destructive. And then it's easy then for leaders to want to drill in and want to solve and want to fix things rather than wanting to understand and empathize, which is the route into more listening and the fine tuning.
That's true. It made me think about when you started saying about, you know, it's not necessarily easy to listen about yourself, the feedback that you're getting about, you know, how you run an organization. If you're the CEO of your own company, something that you've started in, it's your brainchild, it's your emotional child, and you're very attached to it. So it's not easy. So it's definitely taking a toll. But what made me wonder about that is, you know, when leaders do decide to dig a little bit deeper around certain issues that they find in surveys, is apart from the intention, it's also, who is this for? Why am I doing this? Is this for the better of the organization? Is it better for the betterment of the team? Or is it because I've got some, you know, scars and traumas and things like that, and I'm getting defensive, and therefore I'm going to disprove, I'm going to get to the bottom of this, I'm going to control, I'm going to fix this, right? Which means it's about them, not about the organization.
Yeah.
And again, any and all judgment removed from this, what I've just said, because it's difficult. As you said, we are humans. Leaders are humans as well. And they've got different sets of emotions. We've been through different things, and it's about marrying the two. But in a way, as you were saying these things, that, you know, you can sit down, you can explain, it's about narrative, it's about the messaging, it's about partnering and co-creating and empathy, all nice and great. But on one hand, I think that's a couple of steps further down the line to be able to get to that point. I think organizational listening for many organizations needs to start much, much earlier with just shifting from, it's not HR that's doing it, it's the team leaders that are doing it, right? That purpose, what's coming out of it, and so on. So again, and we rebuild that trust in listening and in co-creation, and then you kind of get to the bottom of deeper issues. So I feel, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I feel it's just to keep it simple at the very beginning, kind of go with a minimalist approach of, okay, if you haven't done it before, if it limps a little bit, you need to start simple again. Don't start trying to change the entire organization over a weekend or over a week, but just kind of build that organizational listening capacity with the small steps.
1,000%. I'm gonna flip it around a little bit though and say, I think that the challenge is we're gonna end simple. I think, yeah, there is a maturity curve. There is a maturity model with listening, and I think, yeah, we've come too far, you know, in organizational life a little bit. We've gone into surveys. It's set expectations. Yeah, at the sort of start of the maturity curve, you've got organizations running lots of surveys owned by HR, very, very ad hoc processes. Managers are recipients of that. You move into a more sort of tactical approach, which is, I think, where many companies are at the moment, which is surveys are very tactical. We're looking at how people feel about pay, or how people feel about well-being, or how people feel about the events program that we run. And that goes back to the sort of tactical owners who update the tactics. And we maybe communicate back to employees with a newsletter to say, you said we did. Then you have a much more strategic approach, which is, yeah, we're looking at, you know, our strategy is to win the hearts and minds of knowledge workers, or our strategy is to increase revenue in an Asian market. How are we focusing? How are we setting teams up to success there? Or how are we sort of, yeah, how are we resourcing our marketing team to sell innovation? So it's a really sort of strategic approach. And the communications tends to be, you know, results, presentations back to people, but a high sense of involvement and sort of co-creation. Right through the other side, that's when it gets really simple. You just have a culture and you don't need surveys because people are talking to each other and you have open feedback, and yeah, the culture is sort of based on that, and people are really clear on where they're going and why they're going there.
Yeah.
So simplicity, simplicity is sort of the end of that.
Yeah.
And it's definitely the end. But if you have a culture of listening and feedback, then yeah, that That's the gold standard. That's the aim.
No, you're spot on. I think the way I see it, as you were saying it, is start simple, then kind of build up that capacity to be really, really robust. And again, once you've got that robust, you don't need that anymore because you've got that kind of inbuilt into your DNA. Then it becomes simple again because you don't need a lot of these things. It just happens naturally. It's people's second nature, aka it becomes part of your culture of how you do things.
Yes. And yeah, the dream state is I make myself redundant. Like, yeah, eventually. Like in so many jobs, like in employee listening, it's really important, I think, to establish that. But ultimately, if you have teams of really empowered, skilled managers and leaders who are sort of practicing that data, and you've got that culture of feedback and you've got mechanisms, then the need for an employee experience listening team sort of changes. So I think once it's eventually.
Yeah. No, again, I'm with you on this. I often say when people ask me, where do you see your role, what you do within organizations as a culture designer, or where would you like it to go in the next 10, 15 years? I often have the same response. And I want to say, I want to be out of a job. In 10 years' time, I want to not have this job. I love it to bits. Genuinely, I do. Yes. I'm in that fantastic position that I do. But that means there's a need for such people, such services. I want to continue doing as long as I can in this hopefully different format. But again, helping at the other end of that curve that we describe, if you've got all of this, it's just, okay, how can we tweak? How can we make it better rather than being at the beginning of that curve? So that's kind of my dream for my job. I'd like us to address a phrase that is often said, and I know for a fact that it's a bit of a pet peeve type of phrase for you. Don't come to me with problems, come to me with solutions. If I remember correctly, you did mention that you're not particularly big fan of that phrase. And I think that's often said within organizations. And since we were talking about organizational listening, I thought I'll bring that up if you don't mind. Can you tell me, because I agree with what you said last time we spoke, but would you mind telling us a little bit more?
I mean, I could spend hours on this topic.
I can imagine.
It was something that I heard a lot earlier in my career. Yeah, don't come to me. Problems come to me with solutions. And I absolutely understand the intent behind it. We should all be proactive. And we should all be sort of focused on fixing things. And it's too easy to complain. And I completely get that. As I've sort of, gone through my career, I've seen so many solutions fall apart. I've seen so many people applying solutions, which are short-term band-aids. Again, every time I've probably run 100 surveys in my time, and guaranteed every single time I do a survey or an offsite or a team building session, somebody says, well, let's put out a newsletter. Let's develop a newsletter. And you get hundreds of newsletters that last for three issues and then sort of fall apart because people don't have the time, where you run out of things to say. And that's a perfect example of coming with solutions or quickly jumping to solutions. I sort of prefer to turn it around the other way. Don't come to me with solutions. Come to me to show that you've understood the problem and what the root cause of the problem is. So, newsletters are a solution, but to what problem? The problem of lack of communication or the problem of people not feeling involved in organizational life? And actually, maybe just better one-to-one conversations with managers is going to help with communication and be more sustainable and the right to be used better. So I think, and that's part of the manager empowerment in the conversation as well. It's not just going, there's a problem, there's a problem, there's a solution. It's really about working together to understand what the problems are, what the root causes are, what the impacts are, and where it's important to dedicate a bit of time, energy, resource to solving them. Because it needs to be impact focused and because it needs to address root causes. Otherwise, you just end up with more and more problems further down the line.
I love the fact, I'm going to give myself a pat on the back if you don't mind. I love the fact that I asked that question because it beautifully summed up everything that we've discussed. And I'm so for that as well, because in the line of work that I do, often organizations come with a pain, which is there. The pain is real. And we work on addressing that through simple ways. But again, often is a bit of a band-aid. We're treating a symptom versus the cause. The cause is usually deeper. What we're working with is the end result of something that's going out elsewhere, be it to do with communication, be it with how teams collaborate, with how they resolve issues, problems of the fact that, you know, they don't deliver things on time and on budget. These are wider issues. You know, I can train you how to give you feedback. I can train you how to plan your work. Absolutely. But I much prefer to sit down and spend 3 hours and say, listen, okay, what do you think is impacting? What's blocking you? Get people in a room, in a virtual room, and talking out and kind of do a brain dump. And that's when things start flowing to the top. That's when you can come in with a hypothesis. That's when you can start with a survey and go throughout the process that you set. So again, thank you very much for beautifully summing that up, our conversation there. And kind of with that in mind, I'm curious with what you've got. I know it's obviously potentially a busy time of the year. What have you got coming up in the next few months? What are you really, really looking forward to? Maybe some projects that will be coming to fruition, will be seeing the light of day. What's exciting for you?
So from a Mirror perspective, we've got a lot of focus, we've got a lot going on at the moment. Something I'm really excited about is a kind of mantra I think we've adopted across the people team of falling in love with the problem. And that speaks to what we just talked about, but how we sort of really fall in love with problems, really sort of seek to understand them. Yeah, a couple of things I'm really excited about within that is working with qualitative data and really getting to grips with our quantitative data set. So it's one of the sort of tools I wherever I go, I sort of keep this with me, Relative Insight, which is a comparative linguistic analysis tool and allows us to look across sort of data sets and take a really objective view of what's on people's minds, what people are talking about. So we've got treasure troves of data we can dig into and really start to analyze. I've been absolutely blown away by some of our beta AI functionality. So how we're using AI to understand focus group comments or survey comments and to start to apply that. And we're at a very early, I'm at a very early stage in my understanding of it, but it's blown my mind what we can do with AI and on Miro boards and, using that to understand sentiment and to shape conversations as they're happening. I think that's incredible. And that's going to really help us, I think, focus on well-being. So I think we're seeing some globally declining well-being trends. And there was a bit of a pandemic peak, I think, of engagement. And then well-being sort of has declined and job satisfaction has probably declined as well across sectors, not helped by tech layoffs and the external environment. So we've got some really detailed listening to do to understand the benchmark and comparable companies and what we can do as a company to be to differentiate ourselves, but still focus on productivity and developing an amazing product that people love and keeping that going. So that's all coming up. Good big deep dive survey coming up and really excited, hopefully towards the end of the year, really excited like what that's going to mean for OKR planning for the year ahead and resourcing into the conversations across different teams as well. So plenty happening, plenty going on. Like say, I think, qualitative data and AI, that's the bit that's really exciting at the moment.
Sounds like a busy few months that you've got ahead, but equally, I'm not involved and I'm excited about it. So I think that kind of speaks volumes about it because it's good. That what you've described will be our future in our organization. So it's about figuring out how to utilize it. We talked about ChatGPT at the beginning and understanding how that fits in. Again, using AI to help us, to help train the models so that, when we do ask it for a job spec in 5-10 years time, we will actually produce something that is relevant and reflective of what our organization is about. Sam, you've been an absolute well of knowledge. Thank you very, very much. We focused a lot on surveys. We talked about organizational listening through the lens of surveys. I'm glad we did. I think we've opened up many, many doors. It goes way beyond that, but I think it's a start. Whenever you are done with the AI research and all the work that you do in later this year, I'll extend an invitation here and now. You're more than welcome to come back. I'd love to find out what you've learned from all of that. So later in the year or next year, it would be great to have you on the podcast again. Sam, again, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great, great conversation. And I would love to come back and talk about the AI stuff. I think in 6 months or a year, we'll be in a wildly different place. But yeah, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Right. That was Sam Valentine from Miro, and absolute has a wealth of knowledge, as I said, when it comes to organizational listening. Before I let you go, one last thing. As always, I'd like to let you know about culture micro practices that help change behaviors and habits within the organizations. And they can go a long way in improving organizational listening, especially that element of building psychological safety and trust. They will help produce better results when you do your pulse checks, your surveys, and when you want to build out organizational capacity in terms of partnering on the stuff that you do. If you're interested, do check them out at human.pm/CMP for culture micro practices. I was your host, Lev Kozlowski. Until next time.